Okay, welcome everybody to this extra lecture. We got a lecturer, we did not get him all the way from Memorial University, but from Reykjavik, but anyway. Sean McGrath is here in Iceland at the moment. He is from the same university, but not from the same campus as Gabriela. So they have two campuses in Newfoundland on two sides of the island. That's a little bit like Reykjavik and Ísafjörður, but anyway. Gabriela made me aware of the fact that Sean McGrath is here in town, and he has quite interesting stuff to tell, because on the first side, if you go on the website of Memorial University, you think, oh yeah, it's a German philosophy of the 19th century mostly he's dealing with. Yeah. And yes, what could he tell you, this group here? But they are talking about, and he's president of the Canadian Schelling Society and much more. I think very interesting, by the way. Yes, but anyway, but they are forming a group that is called For a New Earth, and talking about making a conference next autumn on future of nature. And this is something that both Gabriel and I, we rang a bell to us, and we thought, if we have such a person so close to us, just get him hither. And welcome to come up to us. He was asked by several people in Reykjavik, what are you doing there? There is nothing. But we should take a photography of you all here. Right. Okay. Thank you for coming, and thank you for giving a lecture.
Thank you. Yes, I want to thank Dr. Weiss and Professor Sabo, my colleague, for the opportunity, and I'm really delighted to be here with all of you in this place, which amazingly is not so unfamiliar to me. I just took a little walk around. It smelled like home. It even sounded like home. The architecture is a bit different, and we don't have avalanche danger in our outports, which is what we would call this in Newfoundland. This would be an outport, but it's very interesting to be here. We have a great deal in common. So I was also happy that I could be here this morning to hear the lecture on climate change and the economics of climate change, which is much more complicated than the science of climate change itself. And the thing that struck me in what I heard this morning is that we need to change our way of living. And that is, we need to find a way to live differently so that we factor the earth into our cost-benefit analysis. And to change your way of living, of course, it has to happen collectively. We all have to change our way of living. And to do this, of course, we have to believe differently. We have to believe differently. We have to believe new things about ourselves, or different things than we do currently, about nature and about our future. And that, of course, brings us into the terrain of what do people actually believe? What do people live for? You know, what do we really live for? What gets us out of bed in the morning, generally, as a global civilization? Because it is definitely a global civilization. And that question is a question for ethics, and that's my turf. Philosophy, ethics, so on. Religion as well. So if I might make a little plea for a transdisciplinary discussion about the questions that we talked about this morning in a very specifically scientific, economic way, this great change that has to happen is not going to happen without people having a conversion in their hearts such that they become different kinds of people than they are now. And so that leads us to questions such as, well, who are we now? What do we believe now? What do we live for? What is it that keeps this machine running? It doesn't run by itself. It runs on human desire and human ideals and human aspirations. And that is a question for philosophy. But I'm not going to give you a philosophy lecture this morning, because I want to take the challenge of transdisciplinarity myself, and I want to speak to as many people as I can about our topics. And the last thing I'm going, the least useful thing then would be a lecture on Schellingian and Naturphilosophy, so we won't do that. Just to note, however, that almost everything I'm going to say is inspired by Schelling, who is my master. Friedrich Wilhelm Joseph von Schelling, who is a 19th century German philosopher who's sometimes forgotten because his little buddy Hegel was more famous than him. That's all I'm going to say about Schelling. So we need to believe differently. We need to believe new things. What is it that we do believe? So I'm going to take a run into this by introducing a couple ideas that are current now in environmental theory. You've heard of the Anthropocene. You've heard of this term. This is a common term. Everybody knows what this term means. Okay, well then, it's a controversial term. I believe that in the next, this year or next, they will actually decide whether it is a scientific term. But the Anthropocene as a term was coined in 2002 by a climate scientist, a climatologist, who argued that we have actually entered into a new geological era of the Earth. We're no longer in the Holocene, but we need to actually coin a new term to articulate this new period in the history of the Earth, a period in which the presence of the human being becomes a geological agent. And so, therefore, we can no longer speak about human beings as one species among many, because the human species has become the determining force in the future of the planet itself. And so, therefore, we speak of the Anthropocene. The term, therefore, has to do with climate change, of course. It also has to do with species extinction. It has to do with technology, certainly, because these things are closely related. It has to do with moving towards 11 billion people on planet Earth by the middle of this century. And the term is generally thrown around in a kind of dystopian sense. You know, it's like, oh my God, the Anthropocene is here. The end is nigh. And certainly there's a lot of horror and fear associated with the advent of the Anthropocene. But I don't want to rehearse that, because it's far too easy. I started doing environmental stuff in the early 2000s, and I was just teaching a horror show to these 20-year-olds who were already terrified, and the end of the course was just this blank look of despair, and I had nothing to offer, and that was the end of the class, and I'd walk out depressed. And then I had a son, and I'm looking into the face of this beautiful little baby, and I realized I can't talk like this anymore. Even if it's fully justified to think this way, I'm not allowed to talk this way anymore. I'm talking about this baby's future. I have to start thinking differently about the future. And I think this is our challenge now, is to take the anxiety for nature, which grips the whole planet. It's an anxiety that is all over the planet. This is a unique thing, that the world is gripped by a common fear. I think it's probably never happened before. You could go anywhere in the world, even to, let's try, Isafjordur, and you'll find people who understand immediately what, let's say, somebody like myself is talking about. Or I could go to China, I could go to India, like anywhere in the world. There is nowhere in the world where this question concerning the future of nature has no purchase. So we are gripped by a common anxiety, and that anxiety can easily be turned into its opposite. Because we're all looking in one direction, we can look in a hopeful way. And that would take a great deal of imagination. And this is what we need to find. This is what we will not find when we continue to indulge in disaster porn, eco porn, end of the world, zombie stuff, right? You know, Zizek says, it's astonishing that it's easier for us to imagine the end of the world than the end of capitalism. And I think this is a very true observation, and I think it points to the failure of environmentalism, and I think environmentalism is over now, actually, but that movement, you know, began full of vim and vigor in the 70s. It failed because of a lack of imagination, I think. If we can more easily imagine the end of the world than the end of capitalism, then there's something deficient in our imaginations. So the Anthropocene, then, is often conjoined now in with a discussion about the death of nature, which might be news to you, that nature actually apparently died a few years ago. some very famous theorists are arguing that actually ecology needs to let go of the concept nature. The concept itself is vague, which means it's not precise and not scientific, and more importantly, it's actually loaded with ideology that actually perpetuates the difficulties we're in. It's time to drop nature from our discourse. So that is more or less Bruno Latour's argument in The Politics of Nature. And it's also Timothy Morton's argument in Ecology Without Nature. Timothy Morton founded Dark Ecology in order to start a discourse in which we no longer speak of nature. And it's Slavoj Žižek's argument as well in a very interesting piece called Unbehagen in der Natur, which is a play on Freud. So what are the reasons for dropping this notion of nature? Clearly, I'm not supporting these reasons in as much as I'm here to talk about the future of nature. But the reasons are something like this. So Žižek says technological advances in biogenetics, chemistry, basically in every field, have divested us of this fantasy of nature that stands as the other to humankind. You know, nature, which is our home that contains us, or nature that gives us a moral compass, you know, which was the predominant belief in the ancient world. You know, we can understand what's right and wrong by following nature. This kind of nature, Žižek says, is no longer tenable because it is us who decide what is going to be real and not real in the realm of nature. So when we begin to tinker with our very genetic makeup, we no longer even have a human nature. So nature disappears, Žižek says, and all that's left is us and our technology. And we better get groovy with that, because this fantasy of nature is not leading us in any kind of productive way. So no more nature for Žižek. Then there is Timothy Morton, who says something similar, but he adds a kind of real nasty little spin to the argument by saying nature, you know, the nature of the environmental movement is romantic fantasy. That is, you know, this is the nature of Caspar David Friedrich. This is the nature of Sierra Club postcards. This is the nature of ecotourism, you know, which is now apparently Iceland's economic savior. Here is the nature that we love to look at because it makes us feel alive. We make a postcard out of it. It's wilderness, it's pure, it's pristine, and so on. Through a very nuanced argument that I will spare you, Morton says this romantic idea of nature is the nub of the problem, because romanticism is the origin of our particular problem, because we all became consumers shortly after becoming romantics. The consumer is just a romantic in a new form. And while we continue to romanticize about nature, and instead of looking, you know, very carefully at the interconnected mesh of matter that we depend upon and that we are, while we fantasize about nature, we remain dangerously out of touch with the truth. I think that the problem here, of course, is that who cares what these theorists say? Everybody else is talking about nature, yeah? So Žižek, Latour, Morton say, oh, nature's dead. They've buried it, actually. They're talking without it. Isn't that wonderful? The rest of us continue to need the term. It continues to function for us. It is not for philosophers or however famous they are to tell us what terms are useful and are no longer useful. And I think nature remains a symbol for us that we cannot dispense with precisely at this moment. I think nature has never been more symbolically powerful for us. As a symbol, it's not very scientifically precise. It's vague. But precisely because it's vague, it's loaded with affect. It's loaded with our hopes, aspirations, our religious longings even. And it is clearly functioning in a new way as a kind of the term around which a new kind of religious attitude is gripping the whole of the planet. So nature as a symbol lives. Therefore, nature as a symbol is not dead. Therefore, it doesn't matter what these theorists say regarding nature. We will continue to need to use the term. Which isn't to say that we shouldn't be a little more precise about it. And this is what I would like to try to do with you for a few minutes. we could mean nature in a lot of different senses. And some of these senses of nature, when they're not clarified, they create horrible confusions in these environmental discussions. So I think there is a sense in which anxiety about the future of nature makes a lot of sense. There's a sense of nature in which that is a coherent anxiety, and there is other meanings of nature in which it wouldn't make any sense to have anxiety about it. So let's just try this, okay? We could say nature, we could distinguish nature in itself from nature for us, right?
Mm-hmm. The utilitarian idea.
And we could I think we could give a third distinction: nature without us. These are three very different meanings. So, nature in itself, this would be the deep origin of everything. You know, this is where everything comes from. This is the infinite source of life and existence and matter. Who knows what that is? Maybe it's God, maybe it's an accident, maybe it's a big zero. But whatever it is, it has nothing to do with climate change. And climate change is not going to touch it. And it will do just fine without us. It's nature in itself produces all kinds of things, not just a species that extinguishes itself because it's deluded about its place in the universe, but it also produces, you know, planets that are toxic to all life, or just huge exploding bodies in space and so on. This nature in itself, this infinite source of everything, clearly it's going to go on, you know, at least until heat death shrinks it all into a point without space or time. So we're not worried about that one, right? So we can rest assured it will survive us. Then we have this other one, nature without us. This is a hot topic among speculative realists who are not just philosophers, but now they're like architects and artists and so on. And these people are really interested in talking about things, you know? They want to get away from anthropocentric talk, where the human being is at the center of everything, and they want to talk about stuff that happens without us, like, you know, flares on the sun, or whatever's going on in Alpha Centauri, or, you know, massive objects, or let's say history that precedes us, you know, the geological time, all of this object activity, which has nothing to do with us. And clearly there's no problem there either, right? A planet barren of human beings will still be nature in this sense, and the planet itself seems to have undergone quite a few great catastrophes in the past. So this big object of, you know, nature as big things knocking into other things in a kind of infinite expanse of space and time, that's also pretty safe. There's a distinction between those two, and we won't worry about it. But nonetheless, this is sort of the invisible, and this is the visible. And neither of them are really what's at issue in this anxiety about the future, the anxiety I felt when I looked in the face of my newborn son. Nature for us is what's at issue, right? That is, the nature that is in relation to us, either because we depend upon it to live, or because it depends upon us to do the right thing. And I think that it will be helpful for us to recognize that this is what we're talking about. For one specific reason. Sometimes the folks who go on about nature without us, they want to dethrone the human being from its privileged place of being like the sovereign adjudicator of everything, you know, the privileged self-consciousness in the expanse of space. And that hierarchical thinking, they want to get rid of that stuff, right? And I can well understand why they want to do that. And I don't think hierarchizing the human being above everything is particularly helpful. However, here's the rub. There is something about us which we should pay careful attention to, that we are the ones who code nature for us, and we evaluate it. And it is our decisions about what it is and whether it's any good, which determine nature for us, its shape and form, you know? The golden toad of Costa Rica apparently wasn't worth saving, and so it's gone, you know? But had we looked at the golden toad of Costa Rica and said, hey, wait a minute now, the world without the golden toad is actually a world that's less beautiful, then maybe we would have acted differently. So my point being that nature for us puts the responsibility where it needs to be, with us as the ones who code nature, you know, give words to it, and evaluate it. Now, does that make us better? Why would we say that? Does it make us, you know, let's say, different than anaerobic bacteria? Oh, I think certainly it does. You know, what the microbes will not be involved in this evaluative procedure. That's not their contribution. God knows we depend upon them to do things for us all the time. But their contribution is not going to be on the level of like, the political, but ours will be. So we can't get out of this, let's say, finger pointing at the human being as the one who's to make the proper decision about how to proceed. And that decision will rest upon what this human being believes about himself, herself, and why they live. So what I would suggest then is that we get away from anthropocentric nature and get into anthropocenic nature. Because the Anthropocene is a very clear concept in my mind. That one, it seems to me, is not just a symbol. That's about as precise a definition of a concept as we're to get. And the Anthropocene is irreversible, save at the expense of an unimaginable catastrophe that basically wipes out humanity, right? So the Anthropocene is our future. So we need to become much more comfortable with that. We need to become much more comfortable thinking about a planet that has 11 billion people on it, who they are, what they live for, and how actually they live. So I would like to suggest then that we begin to speak about anthropocenic nature. That is, nature as it is experienced in the era of the Anthropocene and as it is managed in the era of the Anthropocene. Why does this matter? It matters because when we have this new kind of language to speak about something, we will begin to speak about it in perhaps more useful ways. For example, kiss the wilderness goodbye. Yeah? This fetishizing of wilderness, which I am deeply guilty of, is absolutely unsustainable. That is, a planet with 11 billion people on it is a planet without wilderness. Simple. Of course, there will be national parks, there will be reserves, there'll be lots of that, I hope. But wilderness, this idea of a kind of, you know, that romantic idea of this kind of wild, infinite mass of things going on in that have nothing to do with us, where we aren't, you know? The kind of thing that used to inspire the romantic poets. This is gone. And if we are to, you know, why does that matter? It matters because the hunger to preserve wilderness is unsustainable on a planet with 11 billion people, or it'll be at the expense of some of those billions of people. You know, you have lots of unoccupied space in Iceland, as we do as well in Canada and Newfoundland. You know, there's a movement to make half of Canada wild and free, and I think that's just very lovely. Meanwhile, there's boatloads of people without water off the coast of Thailand who have nowhere to live. So, you know, you see the point. So the wilderness is not really the model for us to think about this anthropocenic nature. On the other hand, we would probably start to think much more carefully about things like rural life, rural communities. I can't help but notice they seem to be in decline around here. It seems to me that Iceland is just a decade ahead of Newfoundland. The policy in Newfoundland right now is basically to let the rural communities go with the old style of fishing, and we'll resurrect enough of it so that we can have a little theater piece for the eco-tourists. So they'll dress up and sing their songs in some rebuilt fishing outport, but meanwhile, all that's gone. Because we all live in cities now, and we belong to this global economy, we don't need all that. I think this is fundamentally misguided thinking. Anthropocenic nature is a nature in which rural communities play a vital role, you know, in the ecosystem, if you like. That is, the people that live there, who have to live there, because there's 11 billion of us in a few years, they're part of the ecosystem. And the ecological policy, environmental policy, needs to take very seriously, to consider very seriously the health of these rural communities, in as much as it's interested in protecting, preserving a flourishing anthropocenic nature. The same argument could be made for natural parks. You know, anthropocenic nature, just to continue with the distinction, anthropocenic nature is, you know, nature seen from space. There's a movie out now called Planetary. Has anyone seen it? It's a documentary made about environmentalism. It's pretty new agey stuff. I wouldn't suggest going much beyond the first 10 minutes, That's when all the yoga instructors start up. But the first 10 minutes is really interesting because they're interviewing astronauts about what it was like, or what it is like, you know, to look at the Earth from space. And they have no words to describe this. It is the most important experience in their life for them to, you know, and not just for their lives, but for all of life, for all of human life. You know, the first time we saw the blue dot, as Suzuki calls it, in, from outside, the perspective was just changed completely. The film starts with astonishing visual photography, too, of what our planet looks like from space. You know, just like glowing with this life and this film of blue of all around it, which is the atmosphere, which looks like the light coming from within it, you know? Just an extraordinarily beautiful thing. And the human, obviously, the human population as the Anthropocene, in the Anthropocenic age, as the predominant population, you know, united on this, in this one garden. That is Anthropocenic nature. That's not wilderness. We can only see that insofar as our culture has advanced to the point where technology can sustain, you know, a space station. And our economies have advanced to a point where we can produce that kind of technology. So I think the sooner we get into this way of thinking, the quicker we'll be able to get out of some of the ideological mess of environmentalism. And I'll say something a little bit more about that. But just to be clear, this anthropocenic nature, the difference with the romantic nature is that this is a disenchanted nature. This is not nature as the, you know, the cosmos. You know, it's typical of all pre-modern cultures, virtually all of them, to think of nature as a great container within which the human being is situated as one among many. And the law by which the human being should live is sort of inscribed in the heavens, and it's displayed in the cycle of seasons and so on. That kind of cosmocentric nature is gone. This is no longer a way in which we can, I think, responsibly think about nature. And I say this because there's a lot of nostalgia for that kind of return. You know, there's a lot of environmentalism that fantasizes that somehow some kind of return to being contained and belonging by a balanced, ordered cosmos is a real possibility for scientific man. I don't think it is. I think that would be a kind of a lie that we would be telling ourselves. And we really have to stop lying to ourselves at this point in our history. So anthropocenic nature is disenchanted nature. It's nature that no longer... nature that's no longer conceived as a kind of balanced container or a cosmos, but as something which, insofar as it exists for us, is fragile and dependent deeply on the way we think about it and what we are going to do with it. There is a great danger of ideology in the green movement. In fact, the green movement, environmentalism, is shot through with ideology. Ideology just doesn't simply mean, you know, ideas about things. There's a much more specific sense of ideology which comes out of Marxism and psychoanalysis. Ideology is believing falsely. That is, not really knowing what you're doing because you're in the grip of falsehoods. And the Green Movement, I think, is in a grip of a whole set of these falsehoods. So I think the sooner we can actually... become much more critical about environmental ideology and much more vigorously critical about the language with which we speak of the future of nature, the better. Let me give you an example of how green ideology works. Of course, it's everywhere. It has to do not with, you know, what is believed, but with how it's believed. So don't misunderstand what I'm about to say. So vegetarianism, for example. Vegetarianism as an ecological act. You know, I won't eat meat because it's so destructive to the planet, which is, you know, and when we make movies about this to gross out the meat eaters and so on. And God knows the meat production is a disaster. But what bothers me about the ideology attached to this vegetarianism is that it is all focused on the individual and how he or she chooses to live. And so much of environmental ideology does this. It isolates you from a collective, you know, and makes you a sort of kind of a an individual author of your own ecological agenda, instead of thinking much more collectively about, you know, 11 billion people. So, for example, I think it's much more important to talk about rural food production rather than talking about, you know, vegetarianism. I mean, my own perspective is the disaster is that, you know, we eat greens in the middle of winter in Iceland. You know, that's insane. Or, you know, or in Newfoundland, lamb comes from New Zealand. When 50 years ago, you couldn't drive your car without hitting one, a sheep, you know? So the question concerning the rural is sort of hidden by this kind of individualizing of environmental responsibility in terms of vegetarianism. Here's another example, recycling, yeah? Recycling is a great way to lighten your conscience as a consumer. You continue to consume and you recycle your waste and off we go, right? There's a couple hundred million Germans for whom recycling is like the most important duty in the world. And so that the consumer machine can continue to go as long as we take the packages and we separate. Now, I'm not saying for a moment that we shouldn't be separating our packages. But what bothers me, again, is the ideological nature of this agenda. That is, it's the individual consumer who's got naturally a bad conscience, who's now given a means to lighten his conscience, which, of course, is entirely in the interest of keeping the machine going. A Starbucks cup comes with a little brown wrapper that says it's recycled. And you drink it in a groovy little cafe where there's pictures of happy people harvesting coffee beans. Yeah, so your conscience is assuaged and you can continue. The reason this kind of ideology is insidious is because these feelings of guilt that we're having, they're really important. And the guilt is not individual, it's collective. It's entirely in the interest of the machine with which we perpetuate right now, which is destroying things, that we do not get organized, that we think of ourselves, you know, as one isolated little person who can't do much, but at least I can recycle and drink Starbucks coffee, right? Rather than actually questioning in a much, much bigger way what's going on. Organizing ourselves rather than, you know, lightening our conscience through some kind of greenwashed consumerism. Just a few more points, and then I'd just like to open it up for discussion, because I find that with this kind of stuff, less is more. I still have your attention, I can see, but 10 minutes, I don't know. So we'll take these 10 minutes and see what we can do. There's something that strikes me as important about this moment in our history as a species, this moment in which nature appears in an anthropocenic frame. Nature now profiled against the human species, which has become something quite different from any other species. And that is that nature, the symbol, is vibrates with sacred religious aura. Now, we might think, oh, that's just like the old days. I don't think it's like the old days. In fact, I think we create myths about how pre-modern peoples feel about nature. I even wonder if pre-modern people have any experience of nature whatsoever. We certainly do. For us, nature is sacred. Nature is, there's something about nature which has now taken on, occupies the place of the religious for us, you know? We don't go to church anymore, we don't believe in these things, generally speaking, but we still have feelings of religiousness, feelings of awe. And those feelings of awe, I submit to you, are by and large attached to experiences of nature, you know, in the Anthropocene. So experiences of something sublime and huge, like the fjords, or something small and fragile and beautiful, like the little snail in the backyard in Eichenau that my nine-year-old boy named so he could watch it, you know, on its daily journey, you know. These experiences of nature are precious places where we feel a kind of emotion that gets us out of ourselves, and that seems to be unconditional, you know? Like, it is unconditionally valuable that we would actually sacrifice some of our consumer pleasures so that nature could have a future not just any future, not just a mass of garbage, but you know, a nature that continues to give in the ways that it gives to us. So this sacredness of nature is something that interests me. You could look at it cynically. You know, you could say, oh, it's the new opiate of the people, right? We always need a lie, and this is our new lie. It used to be something else, you know, the world religions or whatever. Now it's, you know, planet Earth, nature, whatever. Or you could look at it in a different way, and you could say, actually, the human being who is religious by nature, I believe, schooled in Thomas Aquinas, can't forget these things, now feels its religiousness in relationship to the natural rather than institutionalized religious structures. And that is an extremely potent force, religion. Religion really changes stuff. And if you don't believe that's true, then you don't know much about the history of modernity. It's religion that changed the world in the 17th century. Not the end of religion. It was actually the transformation of Christianity and the birth of secular Christianity, Protestant secular Christianity, that brought about the great transformations that we're experiencing now. So religion is a power for collective change. Of course, it's going to be full of falsehoods too. It's going to be full of ideology, you know? It's going to be as much false as it is true. But it's not to say, of course, that it couldn't be a positive power to change. So these experiences of nature as sacred, we mock them, I think, at peril of mocking everything that's worth living for. You know, that's the epitome of cynicism. I'll give you a little example, okay? So I got taken on the Golden Circle tour in Reykjavik. Not really my cup of tea to be on a bus with 50 philosophers going to see the tourist sites, but I only had this moment. And I was grumpy as hell because of a late night the night before, and because generally I've always avoided such things. You know, I was the guy climbing the mountains and laughing at the guys in the bus, and now I'm on the bus with the rest of them, having just a pretty bad day. Until we got to the national park, I forgot the name of it, and where the fault line is, you know. Thank you, yes. And it was 6 p.m. and the sun was setting, or the sun was lowering, so it was really nice warm sunlight. And the bus disgorged and we all sort of fled down into this extraordinary scene, including myself. And it was a moment of real communal ecstasy. I could feel that in my heart. Certainly I was thrilled by what I saw. And then I was just waiting at the bus and watching as my colleagues came back up, and the looks on their faces. You know, everybody was smiling. Everybody had this kind of light coming out of their face, you know, that as though they had just actually
experienced something extraordinary.
Yes. Why would we mock that? Right? Of course, we can distort that. We can turn it into some kind of ideology that will allow our green consumerism to continue. Or we could look at this and say, well, let's pay attention now to what nature is now in the era of the Anthropocene. It can't be what it was in the past, of course, and we might. You know, I spent a lot of my life lamenting that, you know, fantasizing what it was like in the past. But it can't be that now, but it's something else now. And whatever it is that is showing itself to us now, and those feelings that come out of it, these are going to be key to this change of heart, which will lead to the change in the way of living, which will lead to the better economic models, which Gabriella is mapping so carefully for us. The last point. Nature doesn't end in the Anthropocene. There is a future of nature. What ends in the Anthropocene, it seems to me, is consumerism. And this is something we need to think much, much more carefully about. What is a consumer? Because the consumer is not your ordinary greedy person. You know, consumers are very different than like greedy people in the Roman Empire. Consumerism feeds us on every level of our existence. Consumerism is a spirituality. It is a way of life in the fullest sense of the word. And it actually perpetuates itself because it seems to have everything it needs. It even feeds our sense for the religious. You know what it feels like to open up a new gadget? You know, the new iPad comes out of the box and it's glowing and it has this aura of transcendence, and you feel like now everything's really different and you feel good. Until the next day, of course, you drop it and it cracks, or it's filled with the same old junk for the old one is, and you need a new thing, right? So these commodities that were on the gerbil wheel of consuming, they have this, they are a false religion. They are shimmering with promises of fulfillment that they never deliver. So this cannot continue. There is no way for 11 billion human beings to be consumers on the earth. We know that. It's impossible. There is no future for consumerism. If we can't imagine life without consumerism, then we need to start working much more carefully on imagination. And that, I think, brings me to more or less what I wanted to say. Thanks for your attention. We can just talk more freely now. I have one more thing to say. Yes, this website. If I do this, will it appear?
Okay.
Yes, you're good. So we have founded an organization that's brand new called For a New Earth, which really has as its ambition addressing environmentalism on this fundamental kind of philosophical, religious, artistic level. And what we're planning on doing is mobilizing philosophy, science, art, industry, in order to make it available to communities in environmentally sensitive areas for the sake of opening up a public discussion of the future of our planet. The idea is to use academic resources and lots of capital in order to clear a space of discussion about the future of nature in this sense in areas that are particularly fragile, particularly slated for massive development. And we would like to do this in such a way as not to preach to the people who are there, but to actually free up a space for them to discuss and imagine their future. The reason we bring the big guns in is because the money comes with them, but then the money gets spent on the local community. So we're gonna try our first run at it in the fall in an area well known to Gabriela Sabau, which is the west coast of Newfoundland. And then if that works, we want to go elsewhere, anywhere, and see what we can do in terms of stirring up some productive environmental imagination. Thank you.